In this episode of the Music Bed Podcast, we sit down with Academy Award-winning filmmakers Rika Zatopchi and Sam Davis.
And the Oscar goes to, period, end of sentence.
I can't believe a film about menstruation just won an Oscar.
And it happens so fast, and all of a sudden, it's like the pressure of it, like afterwards, paralyzed me. I mean, it really, like, imposter syndrome was like a real thing.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard in music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. To create your free account today, go to musicbed.com.
Hello, everybody. We're sitting here with Billy. This is our podcast dog that we just got, but also Rika and Sam.
Yeah, you can't have Billy.
Yeah. Can I just get a little background of where you guys met? Like, when did you guys start working together?
Film school.
Yeah, we met the first day of film school.
Where did you guys go to film school?
We went to USC.
USC.
Yeah, she complimented my cargo pants. And the rest is history.
Talk to me about period, end of sentence, because I feel like a lot of that culture is pretty reserved. Like, what was it like breaking through that, bringing cameras to try and have these conversations?
Well, I mean, that was our first documentary experience, at least mine. You had shot a doc before.
I had shot a bunch of docs just as a DP.
You know, I think like one person who was really integral was her name is Mindakini Kakkar, and she was like our line producer. And so, like, you know, because we're also conducting these interviews in a foreign language, foreign to us. And so we don't speak Hindi. So we really relied a lot on Mandy to be conducting these interviews. And then she was sort of like download us, you know, midway through the interview, and we kind of discuss.
That's
but
so nerve wracking, huh?
It for who? For the subject, I think.
Well,
more than
you,
anything,
I guess, having to put that much trust in sort of, I mean, because, you know, like so much of the interview process is like real fine nuance of
this is the wonderful thing about period end of sentence. I don't think I was in a place where I knew what to expect or really what my place was as a director enough.
But it was really interesting in post because we spent all this time shooting interviews where we couldn't understand much, and Mandy would give us little summaries here and there. But it wasn't until we got, it was kind of like shooting on film where you get your footage back from the lab and you can watch it for the first time, because the interviews meant nothing to us until we got the footage back subtitled.
Yeah.
So we got everything subtitled in real time, burned into the video, and then watching the footage with understanding what was being said was so exciting.
Could you briefly, for people who don't know, just tell us what the film is about and describe it for a minute?
Yeah. Period End of Sentence is about a group of women in northern India who start a business making sanitary pads. And the issue there is, like, specifically in that region, and we learn later, like, in a lot of different cultures around the world, women don't actually understand anything about menstruation. They don't understand, like, what's happening to their bodies. And so culturally, there's a lot of shame and stigma around it. So this group of women was really, you know, was an organization that we were working with, who, like, really worked to, in these villages directly with women to try and help and empower and educate them, and also teach them the importance of feminine hygiene. Yeah.
What could you guys just give me the story? And I'm sure this is like something you talk about all the time, but not very, very many people can relate to sort of winning an Oscar for a piece, you know, like what is the story of going from just finishing the edit to actually getting to that point?
It was a long road between those two. So we did we had a relatively modest festival run with Period End of Sentence. Sundance rejected South by Southwest, didn't get into Tribeca, didn't get into. So it didn't get into any of the top festivals, got into some Oscar qualifying festivals, and it did really well.
Yeah.
And sort of really organically, you know, built some momentum. Cleveland International won
the jury award.
It won
right
few,
out of the gate.
It won
the
a few
first
jury
one.
Awards.
Yeah.
But they were all at pretty modest festivals. Nonetheless, it was Oscar qualified. And heading into the fall, it just sort of picked up some momentum. I think like AFI Fest and a few others. And before we knew it, there was a little bit of like Oscars buzz.
Yeah. What does that actually mean though?
It's just like people talking about the film being on different lists and, trades, you know, mostly. Awards in the trades.
And this is something you're aware of while it's going, or is it something that someone else is kind of...
We were learning.
We had no idea. Yeah. And like, we were very fortunate. Again, it was kind of a perfect storm situation where we were very fortunate because like Oscars are extremely political. Like it's like a political campaign essentially.
Right. We had no idea.
Cause you know, we're just like kids going through that. I mean, we didn't like, we made a great film and we didn't like anticipate that it was going to go this far, but you know, there were people on our team initially that like were in Hollywood, like, you know, like understood the PR, understood the like, you know, voting process and all the things that you have to do on the inside to be talking about the film and getting the word out there about the film. So we were fortunate in that sense to have that support. And, you know, before we knew it, it was like, oh, wow, the film is actually in conversations in the trades and stuff, you know, because that groundwork sort of had been laid.
Yeah.
We were waiting the morning of, because, again, it was kind of murky when and where the shortlist was announced because we had never gone down this road before. But I just refreshed my phone literally all day. I think I was on set. I had my phone in my pocket. And it was a long shot at this point. We were obviously hopeful we would make the shortlist, but... And apparently all day I was refreshing the wrong page because the way I found out was I just got a call from Rika and she was screaming and I was like, what do you mean? And it's not showing up on my page. And I think it was like from the year before or something silly like that. But
how did you find out that Rika?
I was like,
she was on the right page.
Yeah, I was just on the right page. I don't know.
I mean, what goes through your, as soon as you refresh the page, then you see it.
Like, I just like started bawling and I was sitting in a coffee shop and this lady was like, are you okay? I was like, tears of joy, tears of joy.
Yeah,
it was like, call my family. We did like a five-way phone call.
We patched my family in and we told
my
them.
Everyone in my family in and his family in. So there was like, there was like six people on the phone because he and I were in different places as well. Yeah. But that was like, you know, career-wise, like that was the most exciting thing that had ever happened.
Oh, for sure.
That was insane.
I think it'd be the most exciting thing for any career. Like,
And we also...
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard in music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. From indie artists on the rise to leading composers, MusicBed has curated the best roster of musicians for your films. Go to musicbed.com and use promo code Rika and Sam to get your first month free on a standard subscription.
Like the shortlist was interesting because like after the shortlist, things get really political. You know, that's where like political campaign really begins.
In what way?
So we'll just go like competing to get like a nomination. That's when like you events really matter, attending those events and, you know, press really matters. And so you have to be on shortlist and before the shortlist, it's a little bit more like fluid, right? It's not as quite as serious yet. So I think that point, it just felt extremely, extremely joyous, you know, and then nomination phase, it was extremely joyous, but it was a little different because at that point, it's like the stakes are higher. You're so much more serious. You're having to like really work for intense. It, you know, and it feels very intense.
Yeah.
So I think the shortlist, like honestly, was like my favorite memory because it just felt the most like pure.
It'd be great for USC to add like a festivals and awards class because there's so much you can learn.
Yeah, or even just like we graduated from film school always looking at our projects, our short films, and finding a way to capitalize on them. Mm-hmm. You know, not just like make a short film, release it online and let it go, but like even when we made Mataran, my first short film when we were in film school, we were like putting it in festivals, learning the ropes, meeting programmers, like, you know, talking about distribution even for a short film from really early on, even when we were just in film school. And then that film also qualified for an Academy Award and we submitted it. At that point, we had no idea that it was political and that you have to do all of these other things, but it taught us something, you know? And so I think like a big part of like film education that's lacking is this idea that like your short films are basically just like a way for you to like exercise your skills.
Right.
Because like we never looked at it that way, only that way. You know, for us, like we look at it as a way, as an outlet, as a way to exercise your skills as a filmmaker, try different things, lower stakes, smaller budgets, more experimental, also more of like a, you know, director's medium, but also a way to learn the ropes about the business.
Yeah.
And like really like you have like a product at the end of the day. How do you sell that product?
Until recently too, short films, there was no market for short films. Only in the last 5 to 10 years, it's become a thing for short films to have distribution.
Yeah.
You know, you have New Yorker, New York Times op docs for documentaries. Even Netflix is acquiring narrative shorts now.
They've been
acquiring
MTV.
Short docs for since period basically. But
and when we're saying acquiring, like there's like good money being spent to acquire these films. Mm-hmm. Like you can not
you
only
can make
like
your money back for
make
sure.
your money back, but you can also like make a good return on it. And it's not like, you know,
no one's going to retire off of short films.
No one's retiring off of it, but like...
Helpful to sustain your, you know, continued just progression, whatever you want to do.
More eyes, but it's more...
Definitely, like, people need to know these things. Like, students need to know these things and like, you know, feels like we're a little behind if we like, you know, people don't have that education.
Do you still have to go through a sales agent in a way? Or is this something that people...
You
for
can.
Short films, you,
but you
for
don't
short
need to.
Films, not
no.
usually.
Yeah.
You could, but yeah, for short films, usually the top film festivals are going to get you the eyes on your film, the relevant, you know, those distributors are going to see your film.
When you enter the world, everything's sort of interconnected, you know, you just like you enter the world and you realize like, oh, so-and-so programmer also has this distribution platform and like the programmer of this festival that I thought was a small festival also happens to program for three other festivals.
Right.
You know?
Another thing that we saw as we were, you know, kind of coming out of film school too, is like some of the programmers at like, you know, Cleveland or some of these maybe slightly smaller festivals when we were graduating from film school and making our first films, programmers, just like filmmakers, move up, you know, as they progress in their careers. And so those relationships are just huge for any young filmmakers listening, and don't undervalue, you know, those sort of lower or mid tier festivals, because, you know, those programmers are as dedicated to their work
as
you are to your own. And they're going to, you know, that programmer who's at a small festival right now, who you connect with in a meaningful way, might be an associate programmer at Tribeca or Sundance by the time you make your first reel. You know, short film.
It's a little frustrating to me just to even hear it that you guys could win an Oscar for that film, but Sundance and TIFF and South By and everybody's kind of like, the idea of how subjective it is feels like a losing game sometimes.
It was amazing to see how after period, end of sentence, we started to get more looks from all those top festivals for, you know, projects that followed, which, you know,
isn't that it's funny.
It's, I mean, like any part of our industry, it's relationship and reputation based. And
what was it like winning, though? Tell me, like, I mean,
I kind of blacked out a little bit.
You told me that you kind of went through some therapy about it.
Oh, yeah. That was after.
I hate being like, oh, you know, like, woe is me.
Well, let's start with
we won an Oscar. I had to do therapy. It's like,
you know, it's a real thing.
I acknowledge it from like a place of understanding the like incredible privilege that so few people have, you know. But I also feel like responsible to talk about the other side of it, because people just think like, oh my gosh, it must have changed your life. You know, you must have had the most incredible experience. And it's like, no, it's actually kind of weird and lonely. And really the truth is, like, I was 25. It was the first time I'd ever made a documentary or anything like professionally, like I said.
Yeah, it happened too fast for you.
And it happened so fast. And all of a sudden it's like the pressure of it, like afterwards paralyzed me. I mean, it really like imposter syndrome was like a real thing because like, filmmaking is one of those art forms that like and like crafts and career paths where like you really like need to spend a long time doing it. And there's so many different moving parts and components, and it's so like directly tied to your identity and like personal growth directly affects your growth as like a storyteller and a filmmaker, right? And so I found myself in this place where I was like, I had just graduated from college. Prior to that, I was driving for Uber, taking really like low level PA jobs, assisting.
And while we edited Period, we were both doing really fresh out of film school stuff, right?
Yeah.
It was like Reka was driving for Uber. I was shooting like cooking tutorial videos. Yeah. Really, really bad time, really dark.
And oh yeah, really dark. Yeah. But like, you know, we were doing whatever we could to make money and also like get our name out there and be filmmakers, you know, like everybody else is. And then to win an Oscar, it's like overnight, all of a sudden, like, you're like, people are like, you can't be a PA anymore. You have an Oscar, you know? And you're like, but like, I can't direct what you're like putting in front of me right now. I'm terrified. I'm not capable of doing that. Reality is I was probably very capable of doing that and was playing a lot of, you know, the Oscar and stuff was, I was playing a lot of mind games.
Yeah.
But then you're like, but I have to make money, you know, like I have to pay back my loans. And so what happened was like, I didn't have work or anything for like 8 months after the Oscars. I was like on unemployment.
Well, the Oscars also was a period of 3 or 4 months where neither of us was working because it was day in and day out meetings and events and strategy and stuff like that. So it's not like we didn't make money on the film itself.
It's either like you take the leap and you start directing the things that were coming my way. I was like, I'm not ready. And I was like, I like crawled into a hole, you know?
Yeah.
I was just looking at that for a long time. After the Oscars, the Oscar was in that cabinet right there.
I didn't want to look at it.
The sight of it.
Would give me nausea and anxiety and then panic attacks. And so, you know, now
you
that
can
it's
see her.
On
She's
the...
in a healthier space
it's,
now.
It's quite elevated now. Yeah. It is heavy, huh?
Yeah, I think
it's a lot
10
more
pounds.
Top heavy than you'd think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty iconic, huh?
What I remember from the moment we won was quite little. I remember walking up the stage, up the steps, and going on stage. And then I kind of like I didn't black out, but my ears it was like a low pass filter on my ears. And Reka was speaking, and I Christian Bale was like right there, and I like locked eyes with Christian Bale, and her voice just sort of drowned out like an underwater effect. And I thought she was really botching her speech. Like it sounded like she was just mumbling up there. And I was like, oh no.
But when you heard it back, you.
Of course. Yeah. When we went off stage, like 10 minutes later, you know, the speech sort of like went viral.
And the Oscar goes to Period. End of sentence.
This is the first Oscar nomination for Reka Zatopchi and Marissa Burton.
I'm not crying because I'm on my period or anything. I can't believe a film about menstruation just won an Oscar. Thank you. Thank you, Netflix, for giving us a platform. Thank you to my creative partner, Sam Davis. I share this with you, baby. Thank you to my mom and my sister. I love you guys. To Lisa Tabak and Garrett Schiff. To Gunit Manga. Yeah. And the women of Katagira, know that you are empowering women all over the world to fight for menstrual equality.
It was just a lot of adrenaline and emotion. And I remember Rami Malek staring at me from the whatever. Mm-hmm. He wasn't staring at me. I was on stage. So, like, everyone was looking at us.
Yeah, everyone was staring at you.
Yeah.
He's got big eyes.
I bet Meryl Streep was staring at you.
And then my favorite part was, like, going backstage. Because when you go backstage, like, you got to go through, like, a whole, like,
you go through the works.
There's, like, a whole world back there. And I was walking down the hallway. It was like this dark, dingy hallway to get to the press room.
We parted ways. So she went off to go do all this. And then I went off to watch clips of what just happened and actually hear it.
And I was down this dark, dingy hallway and I hear, young lady, young lady. And I turn around and it's Frances McDormand.
Wow.
And she's like, I was rooting for you guys. Congratulations. That was like the coolest. That was so memorable.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Legend. But it was a great night.
Legend, Frances.
Very long. the biggest mistake of the day was we didn't have coffee in the morning because we just too much was happening and we somehow forgot to get coffee. And then you go there like 5 or 6 hours before the show starts, maybe even more.
And they don't like feed
you. There's no food there.
They just like they're like literally walking around with platters of like tortilla chips
and like alcohol
and nothing.
A little
just
bit of alcohol
and tortilla chips, and it's like noon.
Oh, I had the worst headache the whole day.
We had like terrible caffeine withdrawal headaches the whole day. Anyway. I just remember like people like Vanity Fair party, like every governor's ball,
all
like
we
afterwards,
was coffee.
Just head pounding, pounding. Yeah, it was fun. Like now I think back and it just feels like this like weird kind of out of body experience. And I think of it as like, that was a really cool thing that like we got to experience that. But I'm a lot more separated from it now, you know, like I don't like for me for so many years, it was like my identity, you know, it's like I was so self-conscious about like, do I lead with that? Do I not lead with that? You know what I mean? It was just like everything was sort of funneled through this experience of the Oscars.
Yeah.
And now it's like different because, you know, I've done the work, I've grown into my own as a person, made more films.
Yeah, you're not defined by it.
Not defined it. So I think back and I'm like, that's a really wild thing. Like, that's crazy that happened. And that's a really cool thing. And I feel grateful to have had that. And also I feel grateful to have gone through the lows afterwards, you know, as terrible as they felt.
How quickly did that happen for you?
The lows? It was like a slow simmer. And I think it really, you know, everyone went through a hard time during COVID. It was a really confusing time for everybody. And I think the sort of like the imposter syndrome, the pressure and the stress like sort of like compounded and really just felt like very, you know, I think my lowest low was like first year or like end of the first year of the pandemic.
Yeah.
We're just all kind of filmmaking's funny. Like, because you spend so much time talking about being a filmmaker and like not as much time like actually making films.
Yeah.
You know?
We make a concerted effort whenever we like go to dinner or something with filmmaker friends to try to not talk about film. It doesn't always work though.
Yeah. Because
most of our friends are filmmakers.
There's like so much to the world and you know, there's so much that's important in life. And I didn't realize this early on because my knee-jerk reaction was like, I'm being sucked into documentary. I need to be making fiction. But I think the one thing that's kept us around really in documentary that I love is the fact that like in order to be a documentary filmmaker, you have to have your foot in one foot in Hollywood and one foot in the real world where you're always observing and throwing yourself into these issues and these worlds and meeting people that are different from you and having conversations with them. And it is a really nice way to like create what I think is a more well-rounded dynamic human being. It's a process of growing constantly, you know, where you're like looking to other people and gaining their trust and entering into their lives. And all it tells you is that a lot of our like world's issues would be solved if we actually did the work to get to know one another and get to the heart of understanding one another, you know, like stepping into worlds that make us uncomfortable and, you know, talking to people and going into spaces that we're not familiar with and coming away just being like, oh, okay, at the end of the day, like you're a human being and I get that. Like I see our similarities.
Such a good point. I totally agree with the idea that like being in documentaries keep you a little bit more grounded. And I think someone who's more of a festival rat trying to like play the narrative like game, you know,
it's a little more selfless too. I mean, and I'm not speaking for all fiction filmmakers, like that's, you know, that's wrong to do that. But documentary filmmaking can be very selfless. I mean, I think about the millions of dollars that are spent on films, you know, and it's not to say that like you can't make a fiction film that's incredibly important and in somehow making the world a better place, whether it be because it's just pure entertainment, it's making people happy, or because it's, you know, specifically about a certain cause or issue. But with docs, you know, you think about the money that is spent on making the film.
It's a fraction, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's a fraction, but like, you know, it's not just about, you're not just thinking about that money and how it's going to go to the craft. You're also thinking about like this story being made and like what it's going to mean to a community.
Yeah.
What it's going to mean towards, you know, advancing a cause.
Is it promoting?
What cause is it promoting? What issue is it helping solve? Like, how is it opening people's minds in a certain way?
I do want to ask, what is it like being sort of life partners and also creative partners at the same time?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's been so long that we've like grown, like, you know, it's all sort of like blurs together. Yeah. There's, you know, there's like not really much of a line.
Yeah, there. That can be hard because it's like, when do you shut it off? You know, if your work, so, you know, we don't want to like be at dinner together and talking exclusively about a project or something.
Sometimes it just depends, you know?
Yeah.
It depends on like where you're at together on something. But I mean, I appreciate it so much because this process of like navigating the industry when you're young can be really lonely and really confusing. And I think like at the end of the day, like having someone to go through all of that with and grow together with is like one of the most beautiful things to, I think, have happened. Like, what, you know, I think back to like USC and I'm like, what's one of the greatest things that came out of that? Oh, meeting Sam and like having this kind of like lifelong friendship and collaboration. Where to this day, like we've gotten much better at communicating with one another, I think, like in our collaboration and in our relationship. But like having someone that you're like always keeping it real with to the point where it's uncomfortable, you know, and then you just get comfortable being in the uncomfortable. It's not like a, you know, it's not like an issue anymore where you're like always challenging yourself because, you know, you're each other's biggest fans.
Yeah.
I also work with other directors as a DP, and it's interesting because, like, Reich and I obviously don't have that. With someone else, there's a degree of politeness.
Right.
And professionalism. And with us, obviously, we cut through that because we're,
you have
for
more,
better
more
or
than
worse,
like a shorthand.
For practice. Sure have a shorthand, but also, like, yeah, I don't have to. If something's a bad idea, you know, with a director I'm working with for the first time on a commercial or something, I'm not going to say,
there's no bad ideas.
No, we're not doing that. It's a bad idea.
Or you're polite and you're like, no, nothing's a bad idea. You're
with
like, that's
us,
a terrible
like,
idea.
We don't have that. We don't have that filter. And so it's more painful. It's harder to not get angry at each other or to, you know, to not have a reaction this way.
Yeah.
But we've, like she said, we've learned, I think, to communicate well. And at the end of the day, like we're able to make better stuff because we're not precious like that.
What was like the first thing that you guys were like, let's make something together?
Probably the first narrative short that I directed when I was in college. It was a really like tough time for me. My dad, who was struggling with cancer, had been struggling with cancer for 4 years. His condition really worsened like my first year at film school, my first semester specifically at film school. It was the first time I was, you know, living away from home on my own and not really able to spend a lot of time with family. And his condition worsened and he unfortunately passed away my like spring break, basically. And you know, for me, there was like a big question because it was like life shattering, you know. It was like my dad, I've always been close to my parents. And, for me, it was just a question of like, what do I do? Like, do I continue going to film school? You know, do I continue like my education right now? Do I like go home and take a break? And I basically decided like to come back to school after spring break and kind of throw myself into a project. Because I knew like, you know, that's really what my dad would have wanted. And I was like ready to kind of complete or fulfill that commitment. So there was a short film, the story that I was really interested in. We rounded up our whole class and Sam was like, integral. He was like, you know, one of the main people that really like showed up and supported me through that process. You know, he was the cinematographer and the editor of the film. And that was kind of the first time that we worked together in that way. Little did we know that, you know, that was going to happen a lot more, you know, on a lot of our projects. But yeah, I mean, I think it was a really amazing experience. And for me, it wasn't just the experience of directing a film for the first time, but it was also like doing it while going through this grieving process.
Yeah.
So it was like a really, I think, a big period of growth.
I'm only assuming that Are You Still There?
Right.
Very much based on that time. Like how long ago was that? That period of your life?
15. Coming on 8 years ago now.
Was there an intuition of like doing it right away, or did you need to kind of sit with that feeling for a long time before you wrote something about it? Or
doing Are You Still There right away?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. There was like, I was not ready even 7 years. I mean, when we made Are You Still There, it was probably 6 years later. I was not even ready six years later to do that. Sam and I co-wrote and co-directed the film. And I don't think I would have made it had it not really been for Sam.
Yeah.
You know, it was really actually Sam that like called attention to the idea and the concept.
Mm-hmm. We were driving home from Orange County one day where Rika's mom lives. And we drove by the spot where Rika had broken down one day after her dad passed away. That was sort of the moment she like reached for her phone to call her dad for help and instinctively. And she told me that story when we drove by the spot. And as she told me, it just, you know, I kind of saw the whole thing. And I said, what do you think about making a film about that? And it probably took you a while to warm up to the idea because it's so vulnerable and personal.
Yeah, I didn't immediately see it. I think it takes like a level of separation to like, you know, go there.
I want to dive into a little bit to the production of it because one, it's like so stunning. Like the cinematography of it is so stunning. You guys shoot it in Orange County where it actually happened? No?
No, we shot it in Sun Valley. In LA.
Very randomly. We spent so long scouting locations. Mm-hmm. We spent several months driving around different parking lots and donut shops and eventually landed on this little donut shop in Sun Valley. Yeah.
What was it about that one that was like, you know, after so many months, why did that one like stick out to you?
It wasn't about the donut shop as much as it was about the whole environment. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of the film is like, she's basically trapped in her car in this parking lot outside of a donut shop the whole film. And so the like sort of geography had to make sense, you know. Yeah. It was about it was also like we were shooting in a live functioning strip mall, right? And so there's a lot of like incoming traffic and it's busy. There's like a highway like right on the other side of the parking lot. And so, you know, we also were thinking about approaching it kind of from like a documentary approach because, you know, we've spent so much time making documentaries now. We wanted to bring those sensibilities into this film.
How do you make something feel documentary in a narrative space?
It's like a million little things. It's just the nuances of like making sure things don't feel too perfect, too designed. Obviously, it depends on the project. But whenever we know that we really want to go for like a grounded, more documentary feel, and we're looking for locations, as Sam said this on his last film, said like, you know, it's not a location that you're going to find on a list on the website. You know, it might not even be on Yelp.
Right.
It's the type of like location that maybe has been there for like decades and you just walk by and no one even pays attention to.
Yeah.
So like not just nondescript, but also just like lived in and kind of, you know, imperfect and maybe insignificant in a lot of ways.
Yeah. We were scouting for a bar location, a really grungy bar location for another project. And we went like all through the Midwest. Every state has like a top 10, you know, best, greatest, most iconic dive bars in Minnesota, Michigan, wherever. And we created a whole database of those that we were going to scout in Michigan specifically. And while we were scouting and striking out, we drove by this little hole in the wall, which like Rika said, was not on any list. And it was just perfect. We walked in. And so sometimes, you know, finding those kind of off the beaten path locations or people that feel like, we like to say secrets, yeah. Like we like our films to feel like secrets in a way. And casting is the same thing, and just as integral a part of creating that sort of documentary feel. The lead in the film had never acted before. And I think you can feel that in the best way.
And then you also work with them, you know, knowing that they haven't acted before. So mm-hmm. you're not like sticking, you know, to a script in directing them. You're talking more about the circumstance. You're talking more about sort of their headspace, what it feels like to be where they are in this moment, emotionally, spiritually, physically. And then you kind of, you know, like they memorize the script, but then you throw it away and whatever comes out, you know, we're less precious about like sticking to the lines and more precious about making sure that, you know, you're capturing the feeling that you want in that certain instance. I also think what's really important is like spending enough time in a specific place, mm-hmm. you know, spending enough time to like absorb the nuances, the details of the place, whether that be like the locations or even just like, you know, like we shot Are You Still There? And even as we were shooting, as we had our production schedule laid out and, you know, we had a plan, there were still like sort of wild card moments throughout the day where we were like, you know, someone rides by on their bike right. and our producer's running after him, you know, asking if he would like to be in a movie and, you right, know, giving right. him a release.
Could he ride his bike by again?
Yeah. Could he do it again in the shop? Because it just happened on accident and it was perfect because it just felt so honest, you know, it just felt like something that you wouldn't think of to direct. And
leaving
so.
Room to be able to take inspiration from the actual, you know, the place or the people. Like, we don't like to write our films fully until they're cast either, because we like to be able to know who we're writing for. So we might, like with Are You Still There, we had the idea. We knew we were going to tell a very simple story about something seemingly trivial on the surface and then sort of peel back layers. But beyond that, we didn't go into like really writing a script until we found our cast.
It's funny because I feel like as filmmakers being so heavy in doc for so many years, was there ever this intuition to like get away from the doc feel for your narrative stuff? You know what I mean?
Well, like, we never intended to go into documentary really. Like Period, End of Sentence was our first documentary together, and our like film school experience was 100% narrative. We never gave a thought to documentary. But Period, End of Sentence happened to happen at sort of this like the beginning of a renaissance in documentary filmmaking, right. where docs are, you know, for a long time were primarily made with a journalistic approach. You know, right, it wasn't right. about the look or feel or the delivery of the story. It was just about getting it on camera. And so,
yeah. Or it was like a TV documentary or something. Right. And then with streaming, it's like, you know, we started seeing like docs that felt like films and were like widely commercially available to people. We found ourselves kind of in this perfect storm situation where it was like the timing couldn't have been more perfect. And so all of a sudden, when you have such a big response and accolade for Period, End of Sentence, and you're kind of like, we're so young, it was like basically the first thing that I think professionally we had made ever. Yeah. Like coming out of film school, then all the opportunities became about documentary.
Yeah. And I think for a long time we pushed back on that because we still didn't consider ourselves documentary filmmakers. Right. So Rika especially had every opportunity in the documentary world, but all she really wanted to do was make a narrative feature at that point. I think we'll always do both narrative
for
and
sure.
documentary.
Yeah.
Because
I also think like times have now changed. Now you're having like a whole, like documentaries are exciting, and for us they're exciting because they're exciting creatively. They're a lot more elevated and people are taking risks and trying things. And so now we look to documentary as like anything goes, you know, like every doc that we do, any project that we do, we're just thinking about like, how can we like do something new creatively that's exciting to us that we've never done before? How can we explore something new and kind of push the boundaries in some way? Because I think, we never stopped looking at filmmaking through the sort of narrative lens,
yeah.
you know,
even
like
with the documentaries.
Even with the documentaries, right. we never stopped thinking about it in that way. And so what you get is like, you know, a process where almost everything you do is somehow priming you.
Yeah.
We apply so much of what documentary has taught us to our narrative work and yeah. really vice versa. You could watch a film, an interview with someone and have a certain takeaway. Maybe you love this person, an edited film. And then you could watch an entire, you know, 3-hour interview, all the raw footage and have a completely different right. takeaway. And so we just like to think of, we talk about how, you know, staring at people and studying people has taught us just so much about like the nuances of, you know, behavior,
performance and how, behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And how that translates to our narrative work. I think that's like, you know, so invaluable. It's just that experience.
Because yeah. there's another thing too we're not talking about here is like, you know, documentary is only as like true as what your subject gives you. So like sure, essentially yeah. like, sometimes you have subjects that are like, just don't care about the camera and just exist the way right. that they do mm-hmm. if there was no camera pointed at them. Some people, probably more than others, are performing. And that's one layer of it. I think the question that like we're always asking ourselves all the way through an edit is, do we believe? Mm-hmm. Do we believe them?
Well, it was an honor to talk to you guys today. Rika, Sam, thank you guys for inviting us in your home.
This is so cool.
Thanks for showing us the Oscar. Hope it doesn't give you any bad vibes anymore.
Yeah, nope. Thanks a lot.
In the next episode of the MusicBed podcast, we sit down with director Leo Aguirre. He's represented by Stink Films, and his work includes brands like Patron and Nowness, and he's also directed music videos for artists like James Blake and River Tiber.
But you also want to be the stupidest person in the room.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of like a philosophy that's been really important for me, is having everyone that's around you be way better at what they do than you. If I think that I'm the best person in the room, then I think the project's only going to be as good as me. And that's advice that I got from a friend a while back. He was like, you want to make sure that you're working with people that are going to like elevate the project way beyond any way that you thought you could elevate it yourself.
This podcast is a production of MusicBed, the standard of music licensing for film, TV, and advertising. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with another filmmaker you know, and subscribe to be notified for the next episodes.